वृंदावनेश्वरी वृषभानुसुते देवी प्रणमामि हरि प्रिये जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे। हरे कृष्ण। सो in Prabhupada's introduction to the Bhagavad Gita as it is, we are on page 14, in the second last paragraph. Yesterday, we concluded with a discussion about the three features of the Absolute Truth, Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. And we saw how Krishna, the complete Absolute Truth, is the origin of all aspects of the truth. The Bhagavan, the Brahman, Paramatma, as well as Bhagavan. So the distinction was made between God and the Absolute Truth. The word God generally only denotes the controller. The word Absolute Truth, however, indicates something much more than controller. It indicates one who is the origin of everything. So now Srila Prabhupada will continue on the theme of the Absolute Truth being a person. So let us read the second last paragraph, page 14. Quote, "People with less intelligence consider the Supreme Truth to be impersonal. But He is a transcendental person. And this is confirmed in all Vedic literatures. Nityo Nityanam Chetanas Chetananam, Katha Upanishad 2.2.13. As we are all individual living beings and have our individuality, the Supreme Absolute Truth is also, in the ultimate issue, a person. And realization of the personality of Godhead is realization of all the transcendental features in His complete form. The complete whole is not formless. If He is formless, or if He is less than any other thing, then He cannot be the complete whole. The complete whole must have everything within our experience and beyond our experience, otherwise it cannot be complete." Unquote. So the last sentence in particular is a very powerful argument for accepting that the Absolute Truth is a person. When we say that the Absolute Truth is complete, is whole, then Srila Prabhupada is arguing, and very rightly so, that this whole must have everything that is within our experience and beyond. I remember seeing a video of Srila Prabhupada many, many years ago. Perhaps it's one of those Acharya series, I don't remember, where one child is interviewed. And why do you believe God is a person? And one of the Hare Krishna children of one of the devotees. And the devotee child replies, "We have form, so how is it possible that God cannot have form?" So the argument is very sublime, because it indicates that God must have everything. He must have form because we have form, we see form everywhere around us. The trees have form, the birds and animals have form, the mountains have form, the human beings have form, the planets have form, the universe has a form, everything has a form. So how can the Absolute Truth not have a form? Then someone may say, well, we also see formless things here, things without form. Like, for example, the air. The air has no form. So what do we reply? If we have form, then God must have form. We see form around us, and therefore the Absolute Truth must have form. But we also see things which are formless. So what does that mean?
You can see the effects. You can see defects.
No. Yes? Yes, correct. We see form here. So it means the Absolute Truth must have form. Because He has to have everything in our experience and out of it. We also see formless things. So it means that the Absolute Truth is also simultaneously formless. That is the important point. So He has a form and He is also formless. So because formlessness and form are both part of our experience in this world, so how can God not have these two? If He is to be complete, then as Prabhupada says, He must have everything that is in our experience and also that which is beyond our experience. So the question now arises that if God, or the Absolute Truth rather, has a form and is also formless, which of them is He ultimately? Because the impersonalists don't deny that God has a form, but they say that the original is the impersonal. From the impersonal comes the personal. And the devotees say exactly the opposite. They say ultimately God has a form, and from that form comes the impersonal. So which of the two is correct? Logically. Forget that you have heard and understood Bhagavad Gita. Just logically, which seems more correct? Yes. Why does the form seem more correct? That's all right. Every positive has a negative. If negative is there, positive must be there. That's all right. We have already accepted that both the form and the formless are existing. Now the question is, which is the original? Is the form the source of the formless, or the formless is the source of the form? Yes, Mataji. Why? What is the logic? Why? Because form is higher than formless, very correct. So form is superior to formless because form has variety. And therefore it is superior to formless, which has no variety. So that is a good argument. You want to say something? No? Okay. Yes, any other argument? Very nice. What does the word formless mean? That which has no form. So the very word formless is defined as the absence of form. So it goes to show that the formless is subordinate to the form. It is only the absence of form that creates formlessness. So naturally form is superior. Any other argument? Actually, it is our experience also that behind everything, ultimately there is a person. Person means form. Prabhupada gives the example of a government. He says, we say the government did this and the government passed this law. So the word government is rather impersonal. It's something that is not clearly defined, a little vague. So the government represents one big bureaucracy, something out there that is making some laws. But ultimately, if you see, a government is composed of some people. And ultimately the persons who have made a law exist. They are individuals. So the personality is superior to the impersonality. The personal is a source of the impersonal. So we have experience of all this even in our day-to-day life. In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says, avyaktam vyaktimapannam manyante mam abuddhayah param bhavam ajananto mamavyayam anuttamam. This is the 24th verse of the 7th chapter. It's a very well-known verse. It's something very important for devotees to memorize because it gives us Krishna's own statement about which of the two is superior, the personal or the impersonal. He says, avyaktam. Avyaktam means from the unmanifest. Unmanifest is impersonal. So avyaktam means from the unmanifest. Vyaktim apannam. Apannam means produced or achieved. Vyakti means a person. It doesn't say vyaktam, it says vyakti. Vyaktim. So avyaktam vyaktim apanna. The fact that a personality is produced from unmanifest impersonality, this is the opinion of some people. Manyante, some people imagine like this, mam, that I am ultimately avyakta, impersonal, and that I achieve a personal form out of this impersonality is the opinion of some who are abuddhayah, who are less intelligent. But param bhavam ajanantah, but they do not know my supreme nature. They are less intelligent. They have a poor fund of knowledge. They do not know that my superior nature is avyayam and anuttamam. It is imperishable and it is very subtle and supreme. In the previous verse to this one, Krishna has already reprimanded those who are devotees or worshippers of the demigods. And he says, antavattu phalam tesham tad bhavatti alpamedhasam devan deva yajo yanti mad bhakta yanti mamapi. He says, those whose intelligence is very meager, alpa buddhayaha, alpa means very small, buddhayaha means those of intelligence. So alpa buddhayaha means those who have very little intelligence. What do? They worship the demigods. Antavattu phalam tesham, and the fruits of such worship are temporary. Antavat, that means which are destined to end. So the worshippers of the demigods are less intelligent because they worship the demigods to get fruits which are temporary. Why should we ask for something temporary? We should ask for something eternal. But the demigods themselves are not eternal. So how can they give us an eternal benefit? So therefore Krishna says that those who worship the demigods are not intelligent. And then in order to distinguish the demigods from Krishna, Krishna himself says, devan deva yajo yanti. Deva yajaha, those who worship the devas, the demigods. Yanti, they go where? Devan. They go to the planets of the demigods where the demigods reside. Mad bhaktan yanti mamapi. But my devotees, Krishna says, they go to my abode, Krishna Loka. So having described the worshippers of the demigods as less intelligent, in the very next verse, Krishna says, not only the worshippers of the demigods, But even those who consider me to be ultimately impersonal are also less intelligent. Abuddhayaha. Because they imagine that ultimately I am avyakta, I am unmanifest and formless, and they think that when I incarnate in this world as a person, that person is produced, that personality is produced from that impersonal. Because they do not understand that my transcendental nature is to be the transcendental person. That in the ultimate analysis, I am a person. I am a transcendental person with a form. So Krishna is condemning both the demigod worshippers and the impersonalists as being less intelligent. Prabhupada gives another very sublime argument somewhere in relation to this verse. Antavattu phalam tesham verse. And the next one. He says that when Krishna is saying Devan Deva Yajo Yanti, that the worshippers of the demigods go to the demigods, Krishna or even the impersonalist commentators, they do not deny that the demigods have a form. They do not deny that the demigods are persons. They do not deny that the planets of the demigods exist in this material world. And in the very next line of the same verse, when Krishna says, Mad Bhaktan Yanti Mamapi, that my devotees reach my planet, why should we then imagine that Krishna doesn't exist as a person, that he doesn't have a form, and that he doesn't have his own planet, Krishna Loka? So Prabhupada says it's illogical and it's a fact. Because when Krishna is saying the worshippers of the demigods go to the demigods' planets, the devotees of Krishna go to Krishna's planet, the impersonalists are saying that only Krishna is formless, but the demigods are people. How does that work out logically? You should be consistent in your logic. If you say the demigods are persons, they have their planets, then Krishna is also a person and he has his planet. Of course, there is a difference in that Krishna is a transcendental person and the demigods are material personalities. Nevertheless, both are persons. So how can you say that Krishna is ultimately impersonal? It doesn't make sense. So therefore we can understand that the form is superior to the formless aspect of the Lord. Also elsewhere we see, and as Prabhupada is going to talk about this very often in the text of the in the commentary in the Bhagavad Gita, that one cannot understand God as the ultimate person unless one is fortunate enough to have his mercy. One may speculate for a long time. One may study the Vedas. One may perform many austerities. But still, to understand the absolute truth as a person is not so easy. It is not a product of ordinary intelligence. It's not that by material intelligence and analysis and scholarship we can come to the conclusion that the Lord is a person. It requires the Lord's mercy. Materially speaking, many of these impersonalist philosophers are highly intelligent. And their philosophy and word jugglery is extremely complicated and bewildering. It can bewilder the mind of even very, very intelligent people. Such is their flow of argument and logic and jugglery of words. Therefore, the Chaitanya Charitamrita prohibits devotees from hearing and reading such literatures and talks. So Brahmaji, in his prayers in the Srimad Bhagavatam, says, Athapite deva padam bujadvaya prasadaleshanugrihita evahi janati tatvam bhagavan mahimno na chanya eko pichiram vichimvan. Brahmaji is saying, my dear Lord, unless one is favored by a trace, lesha, anugrihita evahi, by a small trace, a fraction of an atom of the mercy of your two lotus feet, Padambuja Dvaya. Pada means feet, Ambuja is lotus, Dvaya means two, Prasad means mercy. Unless one is favored by even a small fraction of the mercy of your lotus feet, one cannot understand the greatness of your personality. Janati tattvam bhagavan mahimno. Mahima, the greatness, bhagavan, of your personality, of you as a person. Na chanya ekah api chiram vichinvan. Vichinvan means to speculate. One cannot so understand your personality even if one has speculated for many, many years and lifetimes. Whereas one who may not have thus speculated, one who may not be so great a scholar, may have understood the truth of the Lord as a person simply because he or she has received an atomic portion of the mercy of the Lord's lotus feet. So therefore we can understand that only very fortunate few in this material world actually understand Krishna as a person. Most of the religions in the world do not understand God as a person. Let's take Islam. Islam doesn't understand God as a person. If you try to give a form to God, they consider it as blasphemy, and they will probably kill someone who tries to do something like that. The Sikhs also do not understand God as a person. They have a strong trace of impersonalism in the way they present their philosophy. The Buddhists are downright atheists. For them, everything is formless, no question of God. Now, everything is non-existent, not just formless. At least the Mayavadis believe there is something that is real, Brahma Satya Jagat Mithya, that at least Brahma is real. But they do not even accept Brahma as real. Everything is illusion according to them. The Christians mostly have no clear conception of the personality of God. They talk of the Holy Trinity, the Father, the Son and the Holy Ghost, but they don't really have a clear conception. There are some Christian sects like the Jehovah's Witnesses who very strongly preach that God is a person. So that's one thing we can appreciate about them, whatever else may be their philosophy. But at least they accept God is a person. Otherwise, most of the religions worldwide either straight away flatly deny that God is a person, or they have no clear conception of the personality of God. And even in the Vedic system, you find by and large people have an impersonalistic bent of mind, because that's all they have heard. That's all the people who come and give lectures in the television or in the pandals everywhere, or the big spiritual discourses, they all speak like that eventually. That is their conclusion. So the common man also begins to believe that God is impersonal. It is fashionable nowadays in the secular world to believe in an impersonal God, because it sounds more secular. If you say God is a person, then his name is Krishna, it sounds like a Hindu God. So now those who want to propagate secularism, they feel that if they advocate or accept Krishna as God, then they are not being impartial. So all these strange conclusions come up because they think of the absolute truth of God in terms of some narrow religion or some narrow language or caste or community barriers. Because the word Krishna is Sanskrit, it doesn't mean that Krishna is a Sanskrit God or a Hindu God. God is God. So because of such confusions and modern false theories like the so-called secularism theory, people end up propagating all kinds of falsehoods. So it is very rare indeed for people to accept God as a person. And therefore we can understand only those few who have been bestowed upon, who have been bestowed or given the mercy of the Lord, can actually understand. So let us read on further, Srila Prabhupada's purport. The last paragraph, page 14. The complete whole, the personality of Godhead, has immense potencies. Parasya Shaktir Vividhaiva Shruyate. How Krishna is acting in different potencies is also explained in Bhagavad Gita. The phenomenal world or material world in which we are placed is also complete in itself because the 24 elements of which this material universe is a temporary manifestation, according to Sankhya philosophy, are completely adjusted to produce complete resources which are necessary for the maintenance and subsistence of this universe. There is nothing extraneous, nor is there anything needed. This manifestation has its own time fixed by the energy of the Supreme Whole, and when its time is complete, these temporary manifestations will be annihilated by the complete arrangement of the complete. There is complete facility for the small complete units, namely the living entities, to realize the complete. And all sorts of incompleteness are experienced due to incomplete knowledge of the complete. So Bhagavad Gita contains the complete knowledge of Vedic wisdom. Unquote. Can you get any better commentator than Srila Prabhupada? So as I was mentioning yesterday, it's hard to decide which lines of his words to not memorize. Every line is so full of such depth and completeness. Each line is complete. And in this line he uses the word complete to make us understand completely the complete truth. So let us repeat this one line together. Those of you who have the Bhagavad Gita, please, we will chant together, not responsibly, together. There is complete facility for the small complete units, namely the living entities, to realize the complete, and all sorts of incompleteness are experienced due to incomplete knowledge of the complete. Unquote. So somebody please explain this. This one line. Who would like to explain? Yes. Here in the material world?
In the material world, we have everything for returning to God.
For returning to God, yes. The sum and substance of this is that here in the material world, there is everything that is required for us to go back home, back to Godhead. That's the sum and substance of this. Krishna is complete. Everything that emanates from him is complete, including this material world, and that means that each and every universe in his material creation is also complete, and this universe has all the facilities, everything that is necessary for the conditioned soul, who is also a complete unit, to go back to Godhead. Every living entity is complete, but incompleteness is experienced because of what? Incomplete knowledge of the complete. Because of not establishing one's connection to the complete, the smaller complete wholes feel incomplete. So the feeling of incompleteness is artificial, because by nature we are complete. But because we are omitting what is necessary for that feeling of completeness, we are artificially creating incompleteness. The artificiality is that we are actually part and parcel of Krishna, but we want to be independent. That creates an incompleteness. However, When we strive to reconnect ourselves with Krishna, that makes everything complete. There is no lack of anything. Everything is full and perfect because of re-establishing that connection. So this is the point Prabhupada is making here, that this material world has all the resources, and these resources are adjusted in such a way as to produce resources which are necessary for the maintenance and subsistence of the universe. If at all there is anyone who tries to disturb the order of the universe, there is only one species that does it. Who is that? The human species. Everybody respects the order of the creation. It's only humankind who, being not kind, do all kinds of havoc because they're not kind to themselves and to each other. So they create a very severe kind of anxiety and sorrow here in this material world. But once we understand that we are also complete, but our completeness lies in establishing connection with the complete whole, that is Krishna, then everything becomes complete. Prabhupada mentions here that this material world is comprised of 24 elements according to Sankhya philosophy. So what are those 24 elements? Yes. Little loudly. Name five elements, the five gross elements, which are called the Pancha Mahabhuta. Earth, water, fire, air, ether. So these are the five gross elements. These are called the Pancha Mahabhuta. So that's five. Then? Yes? Three subtle elements. Okay? The mind, intelligence, false ego. That's it. What else? Five karmendriyas. The five action sense, the senses that produce action, karmendriyas. So what are the five karmendriyas? Legs, hands, no, voice, the genitals and the anus. So five karmendriyas, organs of action. Then what else? Five jnanendriyas, the five knowledge acquiring senses, which are the eyes, ears, just touch your different parts of the face, you'll know, nose, tongue, skin, five. So these are the five jnanendriyas. How many is that? That's 20. Or 18? What about the next five? The sense objects, which are called tanmatras. Tanmatras. What are the five tanmatras or the sense objects? Just see the sense of, just see the senses and see what are the objects that correspond to the senses. What do the eyes see? Form. What does the tongue do? Taste. Second. What do the ears hear? Sound. What does the skin do? Touch. And what do the nostrils do? Smell. So these are the five sense objects, the subtle senses, which are called the tanmatras. Thus, now this is 22, not 23, 17 plus 5, no, 18, 18 plus 5, 23. And there's still one more remaining, 24th, which is? No. Soul is the 25th. Super soul, no? We are talking of material elements, remember. The soul is not a material element. 24 elements of the material creation. So you talked about the five karmendriyas, the five jnanendriyas, the five tanmatras, the five panchabhutas, the three subtle elements, mind, intelligence, false ego. That's 23. What is the 24th? Unmanifested modes of material nature, which is called what? Pradhan. It's called the Pradhan. So we will see this later on in the Bhagavad Gita when we come to the relevant chapters. But in Sankhya Yoga, the material nature is divided or is understood or analyzed in terms of these 24 elements. But since matter by itself cannot work, matter has to be driven by spirit. So it is the soul that is the driving force for all these material elements. So the material nature has 24 elements, but in this material cosmos there is a 25th element which is also necessary, which is the support of everything, and that is the soul. So these are the 24 elements that Prabhupada is mentioning here. And he says that these 24 elements are adjusted in such a way that they provide the resources completely for the subsistence and maintenance of the living entities here in this universe. So nobody can complain that there is no arrangement for his or her maintenance. So if there is a lack, perceived lack of an arrangement, it means that this is an incompleteness that is due to a lack of connection with the complete whole. To say that there is scarcity of food in the world is an artificial thing, because Krishna's arrangement is complete. So there is no question of scarcity. So scarcity is an artificial creation because mankind has artificially made divisions and said, this is mine, that is not, that is yours. And so we try to keep for ourselves as much of material resources as we can, and in the process we try to deprive others of that. It is a common fact that many countries like America, for example, when there is excess production of grain, which usually there is, they dump millions of tons of grains into the sea just in order to keep the prices of the grains in the market sufficiently high. Because if all this excess grain floods the market, the prices will fall and the farmers will not be able to get a good price for their products. But they do not appreciate, Prabhupada says, that if this excess grain was transferred to other parts of the world, then there would be no hunger at all. Everybody would be fed sumptuously. There is enough land on the surface of this earth to feed everyone many times over, whatever the population be. But because we have created artificial divisions in the world, therefore there is somewhere an excess and somewhere scarcity. There is imbalance. Imbalance is something artificial. It is an artificial creation due to lack of connection with the complete whole. So when there is proper connection with the complete Supreme Lord, then everything will flourish everywhere. So let us go on further. Next paragraph. Page 15. All Vedic knowledge is infallible, and Hindus accept Vedic knowledge to be complete and infallible. For example, cow dung is the stool of an animal, and according to Smriti or Vedic injunction, if one touches the stool of an animal, he has to take a bath to purify himself. But in the Vedic scriptures, cow dung is considered to be a purifying agent. One might consider this to be contradictory, but it is accepted because it is the Vedic injunction. And indeed, by accepting this, one will not commit a mistake. Subsequently, it has been proved by modern science that cow dung contains all antiseptic properties. So Vedic knowledge is complete because it is above all doubts and mistakes. And Bhagavad Gita is the essence of all Vedic knowledge, unquote. So the fundamental thing we have to take for granted is that Vedic knowledge is perfect and complete. And when Buddha began preaching his Buddhist philosophy and he tried to stop the animal sacrifices, most of which were going on in an unauthorized way, simply it was a question of exploitation for the sake of one's gratification, and Buddha wanted to stop that. When he tried to protest the slaughter of animals, then many of the so-called brahmanas and others said, well, it's part of our scripture. It's there in the Vedas. And Buddha's immediate response then was, well then, I don't accept your Vedas. I don't accept that the Vedas are infallible. Prabhupada uses the word infallible here. All Vedic knowledge is infallible and complete. So Buddha said that I don't accept the Vedas as infallible. And in fact, Prabhupada mentions elsewhere that this is the very characteristic of atheism. Atheism is defined as something that doesn't accept the Vedas. So if anybody is not accepting Vedic knowledge, we understand him to be atheistic. Because in the Vedic knowledge, God is accepted. The Vedic knowledge is created by God. And by the Vedic knowledge, God is to be understood. That's the only purpose of Vedic knowledge. Vedaischa sarvair aham eva vedyah vedanta krit vedaveva chaham. So if somebody denies the Vedas, then how can he be a theist? So therefore Buddhist religion is actually considered just another form of atheism. And factually the Buddhist, a knowledgeable Buddhist or a knowledgeable Jain will accept that there is no God. Will say it clearly. Those who are not properly trained in the Jain or Buddhist philosophy may think that there is God. They may accept that there is God because they are not yet sufficiently, shall we say, converted. But one who is a hardcore Buddhist or a Jain will straight away say there is no God. There is no Bhagavan. That is a basic tenet of their religions, of their philosophy. That God does not exist. There is no question of God. So out and out atheism. However, if we deny the Vedic knowledge, then we deny the very road to perfection. Because it is only through Vedic knowledge that we can understand that which is beyond our senses. That which is beyond the senses cannot be understood by means of the senses alone. We need some help. Knowledge that is beyond the senses is knowledge about God. Therefore God is called Adhokshaja. What is the meaning of the word Adhokshaja? Yes. One who is beyond the senses. In other words, if you want to understand God who is beyond the senses, then we have to take knowledge from some source that is also beyond the senses. The senses have their utility and their useful role to play in understanding knowledge, no doubt. For example, we are hearing now and speaking Bhagavad Gita. So we are using our tongue, we are using our ears, we are using our eyes. So it's not that sense perception is wrong. Not that sense perception is useless. But sense perception cannot be the foundation. It cannot be the basis or the reason for accepting something as truth. Because the senses can deceive us. The senses are imperfect. So once the knowledge is received from a higher source, then we are safe. However, if we at the very beginning cut off our connection with Vedic knowledge and say that it is not infallible, we don't accept it, then we lose the opportunity to understand that which is beyond the senses. And we will remain here in the realm of the senses in this material world. So sometimes the Vedic scriptures may say things which appear to us to be contradictory, or they may appear to us to contradict what we perceive with our senses. But we should still accept the Vedic version. Prabhupada gives the example in this paragraph about cow dung. Although it doesn't make sense why only cow dung should be pure, when the general rule is that the dung of any animal is impure, and you're supposed to take a bath when you even touch cow, any other dung, what is so special about the cow that the cow is the dung is a purifying agent? Instead of having to take a bath when you take cow dung, when you're impure, if you touch the cow dung, you become pure. So there doesn't seem to be any logic in that. What is so special about the cow? But we accept because the Vedas say so. Similarly, there are so many other examples we find in the Srimad Bhagavatam. The whole structure of the universe, for example, and many other things given there, they seem to not agree with what our senses dictate to us. When we try to look up, and the scientists and astronomers, they try to have one particular understanding of the universe, and the Bhagavatam gives an account that is sometimes at variance with that. Many devotees sometimes have lost their faith because the verdict of the scripture has differed from the verdict of sense perception. There was one devotee who left the movement because he was told that man did not actually go to the moon. He felt, how can it be? How can it happen like that? It's impossible. Everybody saw it with their own eyes. The astronauts were landing there on the moon with their Apollo aircraft or their spacecraft and so on. So, because of long years of association with this material creation, we have begun to assume that everything the senses tell us is perfect. We have begun to rely on our senses as the ultimate source of knowledge. And anything that doesn't appeal to our senses to be correct, we say, no, it's not correct. Therefore, the modern fashion is everyone wants to see, show me God, right? Nobody wants to say, tell me about God. Very few will argue, tell me about God. No. Their challenge is, show me God. They want to see God with their eyes immediately. But it is not possible. First, we have to hear about God. We have to have eyes. One time when one atheist was challenging a devotee like this, he said, yes, I will show you God. Look up. It was the midday. And of course he couldn't look up. Why couldn't he look up? Sun was so blazing. He said, see, there is Surya Narayan there in the sun. So you don't even have the eyes to see the sun. So God is there, but you don't have the eyes to see Him. For us, the sun simply looks like a globe of light. But the demigods who live in the higher planets, for them, they have suitable eyes to see through the fiery disk of the sun, and they can see the sun god, they can see the other residents on the sun planet, they can see a whole civilization there which is very advanced, that is residing on the sun planet, because they have the eyes to see. But we cannot see. For us, it's just too bright. We cannot even look up properly at the sun. Incidentally, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, this very example is given to indicate how a Jnana Yogi may understand the Absolute Truth only as Brahman. His realization is confined only to the glare of the Absolute Truth, the Brahman. But just like the demigods have eyes to see through the glare and they understand the personality of God, in the same way the devotees are like those demigods from a spiritual point of view, who can see through the glare of the impersonal Brahman to see the personality of Godhead behind that Brahman, as a source of the Brahman. Therefore, the Ishopanishad, it is said, Hiranmayena patrena satyasyapahitam mukham tattan pushapavarano satyadharmaya drishtaye. that, O Lord, please remove this blazing effulgence and reveal your beautiful face, your beautiful form to me, your devotee who is anxiously waiting. So we have to have the eyes to see. But those eyes are given by hearing submissively from the Vedic knowledge. By hearing Vedic knowledge submissively, with faith, accepting that as absolute, then we actually get the eyes to see. Not that we directly get the eyes to see. But if in the very first place we deny the authority of the Vedas, then where is the hope of us seeing anything? Because we are not willing to hear anymore. Then we will only hear the imperfect workings of our mind, the speculations of our mind. But when we hear Vedic knowledge, we are hearing words coming down from a different realm, from a realm that is beyond our senses. Therefore we must, as devotees, accept the Vedic knowledge as true. And Bhagavad Gita is, as Prabhupada says here, the essence of the Vedas. Sarvam etat ritam manye yanmam vadasi keshava. Arjuna says to Krishna, my dear Krishna, everything you have said, I accept as truth. And that's the spirit in which we should also accept the Bhagavad Gita. That this is the essence of all Vedic knowledge. Vedic knowledge is infallible and complete. Therefore, I accept this Bhagavad Gita as it is, as complete and infallible. So we'll stop here. 6:30. Are there any questions or comments? Yes.
Krishna has made all kinds of arrangements in the material world for his soul to give up the mouth and the world. But it is only limited to the human form, but not to the animal form or the animal form. So is that every deva has to give up to human form to get to take the advantage of this arrangement given by Krishna? Or is there any other arrangement for devas who are in the animal form?
The question is that it is said that this universe has a complete arrangement for the souls to go back to Godhead. So is this arrangement only for human beings or also for the animals? Do the animals have to come up to the human form of life to realize God, or is this some arrangement separately made for them also? Yes, would anyone like to answer this question? Yes. Generally speaking, it is only in the human form of life, although there are exceptions, of course, by the mercy of the Lord. But the general rule is, it is only the human form of life which affords the living entity a chance to realize God, the Absolute Truth. And the opportunity or the facility that is given to the lower living beings is that they can gradually get promoted and eventually reach the human form of life. Why has that particular jiva gone to the lower species? Because of his desire to enjoy in a particular way. So there is a facility in this material creation to fulfill the desires of the jiva. So according to that, the living entity has degraded into a lower species, and gradually by the jiva evolves to higher and higher species till he comes once again to the human form of life. And this is the junction in which we have to make the final choice to go out of this creation altogether. Then how can we say this is complete arrangement? But that is a part of the complete arrangement. Is there a complete arrangement for a student to graduate in a school? Yes or no? No. If there is a school, it's a well-established school, is there an arrangement for the students to graduate from that school? No? Do you get my question? If there is a school, from first standard to 10th standard, is there an opportunity for all students to pass out from that school with 10th standard? Yes. For which students though? Those who are in the 10th standard. Suppose I say that, is there an opportunity for students in the first standard to pass out?
Yes.
You will say yes, but
first
they have to come to the 10th standard. Then they have opportunity to pass out. So if you argue, well, the school is incomplete because it doesn't give a chance for the first standard students to pass out. No. The part of the complete arrangement is that all students are given chance to progress up to the 10th standard. And in the 10th standard, then they have a chance. If they work hard and study hard, they can pass out. Otherwise, they remain there. In the same way, the lower species are like the lower classes in a school. And the human form is like the 10th standard. So actually speaking, to come out of this, to graduate, so to speak, from this material world, you need the human form. But some souls, by virtue of the karma, may be in lower species in the first standard, second standard, third standard. So they are in the process, in the pipeline. So they have to come up gradually to the 10th standard, to the human form. So there is no incompleteness here. It's part of the whole complete arrangement. Is that okay? Yes. The comment here is that all other species of life are only meant to enjoy or suffer the reactions of the karmas one has done in the human form of life as a general principle, and it is only the human form that is suitable for God realization, which is correct. At the same time, as I mentioned, there are rare exceptions even in the Lord's own pastimes, but the general rule is it is only the human form of life that is suitable. Yes. Yes. What about the animals who take birth in Sri Vrindavan Dham? So who would like to answer this? What about the animals who take birth in Vrindavan Dham? All animals, yes. Yes, Mataji. They go back to Godhead. So why have they taken birth here in Vrindavan Dham, these animals? Yes. When they do some sinful activities, when? So in their previous life, they were human beings in Braj, but they performed some sinful activities. So because they were born in Braj, they have done devotional service in Braj, they deserve to go back to Godhead. But because of the offenses to the dham that were committed here, there is some purification remaining to be done. So they have to take birth here in some lower species, like the monkeys here. They have to suffer. And once they have, by the course of their suffering, extinguished that the results of their aparas, and they become purified, then they can once again go back to Godhead. So these are some of the exceptions, as I said. But as such, in these bodies, they don't make any conscious effort for spiritual progress. The effort was made in the human form of life. Here, they just have to suffer. But in the process of suffering, they make spiritual advancement. Because Prabhupada said that even the animals in Vrindavan, they're getting purified because they're rolling in the dust of Vrindavan. So even unknowingly, they are making spiritual advancement because they are born here and they are in touch with the land of Vrindavan. They are Nitya Krishna Das. Well, all jivas are Nitya Krishna Das, but they will eventually be transported to Goloka Vrindavan. Okay? One, yes.
That makes us into this particular statement that there is a complete arrangement.
The question is that even in the human form of life, there are so many human beings who are so completely engrossed in sense gratification that it makes us skeptical whether the statement that there is complete arrangement for everyone's promotion in the spiritual into the spiritual platform is there or not. Because for these souls there is very little chance, because they are so engrossed. The answer is, when there is complete arrangement, it doesn't mean that there is arrangement for everyone to go back immediately here and now. Just as when we say, to come back to the example of the school, that there is arrangement for all the students to go back, to go out of the school, to pass out of the school, it doesn't mean that everyone at all points in time have a chance to go out immediately. The first standard student has an opportunity, but in time, depending on his status of evolution in the school. Similarly, every jiva has an opportunity, but in course of time. He has to be at that proper platform where he can be situated to actually move out of this creation. So those human beings who are completely engrossed in sense gratification are like animals. So just as an animal has to wait his time, so also with this human being. The only difference is the human being is generating his further karma by his sense gratification and will go further down. And he will continue like this till such time as knowingly and unknowingly he accumulates enough ajnata sukriti or devotional piety in the association of devotees somehow or other. And then eventually, after many, many lifetimes of such accumulation, one day he will come to the platform of consciously rendering devotional service to the Lord. We are accustomed to things happening immediately. If we say something is arranged, well, we say now, we want it now. But Krishna's perspective is not so narrow. Krishna's perspective can be over trillions and trillions of creations. What to speak of trillions of lifetimes? Because each jiva is evolving at a different pace, in a different way, in a different manner. It's not that all jivas are spiritually evolving in the same way. Some jivas wish to remain here longer, so Krishna has a complete facility to give them here, keep them here for a longer period. Because one of his duties as the Paramatma is to fulfill the desires of all living entities here, according to the Upanishads. So when that jiva desires to, then Krishna will make facility for him to interact with devotees more, and he will get more access to devotional service. So the arrangement is complete still. It's only a question of the time. So the word nitya baddha, jivas being entangled here for a long time, for eternally, the word nitya means eternally, but actually it means from time immemorial. It's so far back in time that we don't know. We can't actually understand when that time was. Any other? Somebody else? Yes. Let us keep to the topic. Yes? We will discuss questions related to the topic. Okay? Yes, Prabhuji.
Krishna in Bhagavad Gita says,
the question is that it is said in the scripture, in the Bhagavad Gita, that Krishna is the creator of the Vedanta and he is also the knower of the Vedas. But as Buddha, he comes and denies it. He denies his own work. Yes, that is for a purpose. As Prabhupada will explain at various times in his books, that the Lord incarnated as Buddha for the purpose of stopping the wrong interpretations of the Vedas or the deliberately wrong interpretations of the Vedas for the sake of sense gratification and exploitation of few. Because there was wide-scale animal slaughter going on in the name of religion, so the Lord descended as this Shaktyavesh avatar, Buddha, to stop this. And Buddha, his purpose was limited to stop this senseless slaughter, and therefore his prime focus was on ahimsa or non-violence. The Lord had a long-term plan, and one of his own empowered incarnations had a part to play in that long-term plan. Once the exploitation or misuse of the scriptures was stopped, then the Lord eventually came in by sending another empowered soul, Lord Shiva, to come as Shankaracharya to establish the authority of the Vedas which Buddha had decried, and yet present a philosophy that was simultaneously theistic and atheistic, that appeared theistic because it accepted the absolute truth, and at the same time it accepted the Vedas, but it was also a form of atheism because it denied the personality of God. So this was a second turning point. And finally then we had the great acharyas like Ramanuja, Madhva and so on, Nimbarka, who came to establish the pure principles of bhakti, theistic philosophy, where God is established as a person, the transcendental person. So it's all part of the Lord's plan. So even though Buddha is considered an incarnation of the Lord, he is playing a part in his whole plan. So therefore, even though Buddha is considered an incarnation, we don't accept Buddha's words. If it contradicts the Vedas, this is the meaning of infallible knowledge. And because it contradicts the Vedic scripture, we don't accept that philosophy. Okay, so we will stop here. We will meet again tomorrow. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaur Premanande.